Welcome to Season 8, Episode 11 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Tuesday, the 19th of May, and we're going to discuss what's been happening in the news and the community. I'm Alan, and joining me this week is Laura, Mark, and Martin. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you all doing? How are you doing, Martin?
Not bad. Just munching on a salad.
Good, good. Glad to hear it. Glad to hear that you're totally focused on the job at hand.
Yeah.
I have a podcast.
How are you, Laura? You have a podcat?
Yeah.
I have no cats here. Aww. Mark, do you have any cats?
I have zero cats.
Well, that's unfortunate. I think we should just probably just get on with it, don't you?
Yeah.
Indeed.
So this week in the news, we have an Internet of Things article. Canonical and GE have done a collaboration for a smart refrigerator called the Chili Hub. It's an 18 cubic foot top freezer refrigerator. It retails for, well, as near as damn it, $1,000 or $799 if you get in early. It's got two USB ports and integrated Wi-Fi connectivity.
Just what you need in your fridge.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know.
What are you going to plug into those USB ports?
Charge your phone?
A cooker.
A very, very slow cooker.
LEDs.
Yeah, I don't know. But they've got USB ports. That's all that matters, surely.
Yeah. You could put a mug warmer.
You'd be really disappointed if it had no USB ports.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. To be fair, yes, I would.
Is it actually called a Chili Hub or a Chill Hub?
You could just charge your phone off it. You could charge your Ubuntu phone off the USB ports. There you go.
Yeah. That's...
It says Chill Hub here.
Chili Hub is more exciting.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I can't read. It's Chill Hub.
So what's running on this fridge?
That would be the Snappy Ubuntu Core powers this particular fridge because it's the most secure edition of Ubuntu. It's perfect for inventors, technologists, and makers. And better yet, you can interface with this open source fridge using an open source iOS compatible app.
Oh, so not an Ubuntu phone app.
That's disappointing. Not but maybe yet. There'll be an Ubuntu phone app coming soon. I can only imagine that just around the corner.
I think there'd be more incredulity, actually, if the only way you can interface to it is a phone that's only available from one niche manufacturer in Spain. I think there would be more outcry.
To be fair, if the iOS app is open source, then presumably any APIs could easily be...
I would imagine that conversation has been had by someone. Yeah.
Somebody's thought of that.
it's great. Yes. When I saw this, it did amuse me because for years, you know, when we've been talking about convergence, we've always said, you know, Ubuntu on your phone, your tablet, and then you just throw in toaster and fridge for comedic effect. And now it's actually...
So what is this just basically, you know, a fridge which happens to have like a Raspberry Pi server shoved in it or something? Or is this like, can you do useful things with your fridge through this operating system running on it?
I don't know. I've not seen it. The first I heard about it was the first you saw it. So, I would love to have a fridge that, you know, knew when food went in and the sell by dates and could ping me, you know, when things are getting close to their use by date or something, or could tell me, or could add things to my shopping list when I take them out and throw them away and stuff like that. You know, if there's regular staples that I always buy, like milk, so it knows.
Sends an online shopping order for
you. Well, yeah, that would be great as well.
I don't think barcodes include the sell-by, use-by dates on items, do they?
No.
You could have a sensor which you stick in your food and it measures.
Well, a lot of food actually
into the USB ports, of course.
RFID in the labels or something. You know, they could be... It could be done. I'm sure it's not. It's not beyond the wit of man. But it was interesting to see a new device that's not your usual run of the mill Ubuntu device.
Indeed. In a surprise to pretty much nobody, Meizu have announced the availability of the MX4 Ubuntu edition in China. Yes, this is the more powerful Ubuntu phone, which we've all been waiting for. The device features an octo-core MediaTek ARM system on chip with 2 gig of RAM and 16 gig of storage. It's available in white and gold, and it's available for the equivalent of 290 UDS. Is that Ubuntu Developer Summit?
It's quite expensive then.
US dollars. Yes. So, yeah, $290, so that's about, what, £250?
Something like that. But at the moment, so it's only available in China, it seems. You can't actually buy it outside China yet.
Right, but so when it gets over here, it might be...
500 quid or something. Yeah. Typical UK prices. Yeah.
Yes. But this isn't the forthcoming convergence device that we were hoping it would be. No. That's something else we're reliably informed.
Right. So this was, I think we mentioned this last time, that Mark said something about a convergence device in the future.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is
this year, he said.
Yes, this year.
This is not it. This is just a cool, powerful Ubuntu phone.
Yes.
So Poppy, considering you've got the inside scoop here and not wanting to put you on the spot or anything, but when do you think we might be able to buy this in Europe?
I honestly don't know, and it's really up to Meizu, you know, what they do and how they sell it, and I would like to hope it's soon, as in, you know, not December 31st, but you know, sometime within the next few months, I would like to hope, but I honestly don't have a date, and I don't know anyone who does, so I would have asked them the same question. Because it's
to be fair, nice. It's unlikely to be difficult to buy a phone from someone in China.
Well,
if you ship
one
it
of the
to.
Problems
surely
with
I've
this
done that before.
Meizu is that they actually have two different editions of their devices. They have a version that they ship in China for before Ubuntu, like the Android version of their devices. They have a lockdown version for the Chinese market, and then the international version, which you can
root.
So you have to be careful which ones you pick up. If you pick them up on eBay, you have to pick the right one. Otherwise, you can't root it and put interesting stuff on it. So
I've bought a Huawei off eBay from which came from China and actually came pre-rooted. I didn't realize they did sort of. You know, I suppose they can't just sell a surveillance-free internet device in China.
Interesting. Well, we'll have to wait and see when it does come out, and obviously I'll let you know as soon as I know.
And Jonathan Corbett wrote on LWN that there are now less than 23 years remaining until that fateful day in January 2038 when signed 32-bit time_T values used to represent time values in Unix-like systems run out of bits and overflow.
Everybody panic.
I think we should be panicking right now, really.
I am.
Well, no, I think we should be taking a considered approach to solve the problem before it becomes a problem.
Not taking knee-jerk reactions. As that date approaches, 32-bit systems can be expected to fail in all kinds of entertaining ways. Is this a lucrative retirement plan for this generation of Linux developers like Y2K was for previous generations of computer engineers?
I remember watching... I can't remember his name now. A guy who used to do Tomorrow's World standing in front of a big map of...
Ian McNaught,
big map of
Davis?
The world. No. big map of the world. When Philippa Forrester was on Tomorrow's World, he was the guy, old guy with grey hair. He stood in front of a big map of the world, which was going to go red every time the Millennium Bug killed something, or I'm not sure what happened. And like one of the bits went pink for a while, and then they decided that everything was okay, and he was there all night.
I think a lot of people have obviously been burnt by the Y2K thing.
But I think they did do an awful lot of work to prevent those things turning
red. Well, yes,
red,
no, I'm
so
not saying, it's not that it wasn't a problem which needed to be solved. It's just that by the time it came to be solved,
it was less fun than it could have been.
But we did all have a last-minute panic with Y2K. I rather proudly in the front room have my award for a successful Y2K transition, which was so successful the whole of the IT department was like massively cold on like February 1st.
Oh, no. because you transitioned
we'd done such
your
a good
room.
Job and they'd sunk so much money into Y2K they couldn't afford anybody anymore. But yeah, I've got my Y2K presentation thing, which is rather lovely.
Cool.
And this is a bit like that. And it would be nice if we solved this problem like 20 years ahead of time rather than in like the last 4 months, which is what it felt like for Y2K.
But more importantly, we need a decent code name for it.
Hasn't there already been like I mean, it's always been known as the
Unix Epocalypse.
Yes, the Epocalypse.
Epocalypse, that'll do. We need a logo as well and a website.
Speaking of logos and websites, Mark.
Venom, or CVE-2015-3456, as it's more accurately known, is a security vulnerability with the virtual floppy drive code used by many computer virtualization platforms. This vulnerability may allow an attacker to escape from the confines of an affected virtual machine guest and potentially obtain code execution access to the host. So the bug is in QEMU's floppy disk controller. The vulnerable floppy disk controller code is used in numerous virtualization platforms and appliances, notably Xen, KVM, VirtualBox, and the native QEMU client. VMware, Microsoft Hyper-V, and Box hypervisors are not impacted by this vulnerability.
Oh, so VMware, Hyper-V, and Box are not impacted, but the others were.
So all of the open source ones
but
are.
But you've skipped over at the brutally sort of enforced acronym here. They really wanted to call this Venom because Venom stands for Virtualized Environment Neglected Operations Manipulation, which makes no sense.
That's just five random words
that gives them an excuse for having a picture of a snake's head.
Yep.
It's all about the branding. It's all about the branding.
And this might be the worst acronym since GNU Herd.
Definitely worse than GNU Herd. Definitely. All joking aside, I mean, if you're running a data center and you're doing virtualization, then this has probably been a busy week for you. Or you've not been using one of the affected virtualization platforms and you've been chortling to yourself all week. That's me chortling.
Thanks for the demonstration.
Yeah, well, you know, it's good to sort of illustrate how that goes.
Schadenfreude.
But the thing I'm worried about is all of these increasingly worrying brand names and brand advertisings that are being used to sort of highlight vulnerabilities in open source platforms. And all power to the information security researchers that are finding these things, because they're doing us all a great service. But I'm not sure the marketing departments that are affiliated with the security researchers are actually doing any good at all. Because what happens is that the lay person just takes away from this. There's all of these increasingly worrying and scary names being attributed to open source software. Yeah. So that must be a bad thing and I should stay away from it. And you don't get this level of sensationalism with vulnerabilities in the mainstream proprietary platforms.
Yeah, but
so
a lot of these do affect proprietary software. You know, the things like anything that links
against
SSH.
For example.
No, I'm not talking about this specific one. I'm talking in general about these kind of things. Yeah, things like SSL affects proprietary products as well. And I'm torn because part of me thinks this is a good thing because people can go out and get information about this. If it was just publicized as CVE-2015-3456, what was that thing you were telling me about? You know, I can look on the BBC News site and see Venom or Heartbleed or one of these others, and I can search for it online, and I can find documentation that tells me why I should care about it or why I shouldn't actually care about it in most cases.
I do agree with that point of view, because I know unless I see a sexy logo and it being on every tech news site in the world, I don't need to worry about it. Or
do you? What about all of those ones which didn't have a brand name?
Or I just need to...
Are they less important?
Or what about, CVE-2015-3455, for example? How do we know that?
No.
It might have been a chipmunk instead of, you know, a big fiery snake, but...
Snake's got a bad name.
Or some other... Well, you could get just a nasty bite from a chipmunk as well.
I expect so.
There's a really, really terrible diagram that's apparently explaining... the Venom vulnerability in action. Step one is adversary exploits Venom to escape VM, and then all the other steps are basically they go onto all your other computers. It doesn't explain anything about how it works at all. Literally nothing. But it has lots of nice biohazard symbols.
It also skips the very important step zero, which is they get through your firewall.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
I think the point Martin made was true, because I've heard people on other tech podcasts who should know better being very, wary of the idea of open source software after they heard about the SSL thing, and literally saying, you know, they preferred the idea of proprietary software because of that.
Well, those
because no one tells you about the problems with proprietary software.
Moving on,
indeed.
Firefox 38 arrives with tab-based preferences, responsive image support, and content decryption module. Is that stuff I should care about?
Well,
it means you can watch Netflix.
Definitely. It's the base for the next ESR release. That's ESR is that extended support release.
That's right. Right.
It's got new tab-based preferences, Ruby annotation support.
What's that?
Yes, this is annotation for
Ruby is
Japanese characters.
Asian and Japanese language annotations to add extra inflection and meaning to their languages.
Gotcha.
Cool.
And then they also added the encrypted media extensions API to support encrypted HTML5 video and audio playback, as Mark says, Netflix, and automatically downloads Adobe Primetime content decryption module for DRM playback through EME on Vista or later.
Okay. So that means that we still can't use it to watch Netflix on Ubuntu.
That's right.
Well, we're later than Vista. So
yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm running 15.04 right now. It's definitely come out since Vista. Yeah, no. So there's two bits here. It's great. The tab-based preferences look pretty. There was a few other new features, but the bits I'm really interested in are this EME and CDM. So EME, encrypted media extensions, that's a JavaScript API for your browser to talk to the DRM decryption module, which in this case in Firefox is being provided by Adobe. And at the moment, that's not available for Mac OS or Linux. And in the show notes, there'll be a link to the meta bug on the Mozilla bug tracker for EME, which has got about 70 outstanding bugs, which are all to do with bringing EME and CDM to Linux and Mac OS X.
That's a lot of linked issues.
Yeah, but you should see how many have been closed. I'd say there's probably four.
To be fair, yeah, there's a big list of closed ones.
Have they released too early because it's not ready? Or is it ready on Windows is good enough for Firefox now?
Well, maybe.
So what tab?
I mean, obviously a significant chunk of their user base are Windows users. Mm.
So what are tab-based preferences?
Good question. No idea.
It just looks pretty. So it opens in the browser window a bit like Google Chrome's preferences.
Oh, I see. Right. So it's not. Sorry, I was thinking it was some sort of per tab settings thing. So it's like.
Oh, preferences
a
for tabs.
Your preferences open in a tab rather than in a separate dialogue.
Not in a window dialogue. Yeah. So,
right. Okay.
I think preferences in Chrome looks like that in Firefox now. But I think Firefox's implementation is a little bit easier to navigate and understand.
Cool.
So in other news, the official sync thing, Debian and Ubuntu repositories have been released. For those that don't know, sync thing is a cross-platform peer-to-peer file synchronization client-server application written in the Go language. It's a tool similar to BitTorrent Sync, but it's open source, whereas BitSync is proprietary, and it can be used to synchronize files between computers. And this, in my opinion, is the great hope for open source file synchronization. So if SyncThing get it right, this is the thing that could put an end to Dropbox and Google Drive.
So is this
BitTorrent Sync?
A Debian package that's hosted on a repo that they host, the SyncThing developers?
Yes.
Oh,
that's
awesome.
Right. So they've got that. So http://apt.syncthing.net. You can add that to your repositories and you can apt-get install SyncThing.
I'm totally going
to Which means it lowers the barrier of entry for people wanting to use SyncThing, which is brilliant, by the way. I highly recommend it.
Does it add all the necessary upstart or systemd jobs so that it auto-starts?
I'd love to answer that question authoritatively, but I haven't done it yet, so I don't know.
I like low barriers.
I'm going to totally do this later. Yes, so do I. Moving on, the Interplanetary Society has launched a Kickstarter campaign to explore the universe with a spacecraft whose locomotion is light-powered. The LightSail project uses a solar sail which gets pushed by photons from the sun.
Awesome.
A tiny bit. Yeah. During a Q&A on Reddit, it was revealed that part of the spacecraft runs Linux and could even sustain a very slow SSH connection even from better. Earth.
That's proper Linux, then.
I believe that it's designed to basically propel a CubeSat.
That's right.
Which are these little miniature satellites which you can buy and have put up into space and do stuff with them as they fall through the atmosphere.
The video shows, yes, but this one wouldn't fall through the atmosphere. And this one would go off into the distance away from the sun.
Yeah.
But the really nice video show on the Kickstarter campaign, which they've already hit their target, shows the unfurling of the foil lined solar sail. It looks amazing how they crowbarred this solar sail inside a form factor of a CubeSat. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
brilliant.
And they're really cool. You can also I've like read about these before, and you can also you could point a laser at one from Earth, and as long as there's nothing in the way, you can use the photons in the laser to push it faster. And because there's no resistance, even though it's only a tiny little push, it will just pick up speed and keep going. It's really cool.
Groovy.
It's just amazing. What a time to be alive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, breaking news, water's still wet. The shutting down of pirate sites is ineffective.
No, really?
The European Commission has found.
Absolutely shocked.
So, shutting down pirate websites such as the Pirate Bay is high on the agenda of the entertainment industries. However, according to research published by the European Commission's Joint Research Centre, these raids are relatively ineffective and potentially counterproductive. Yes. So a few years ago, one of the largest piracy-related raids was mounted against movie streaming portal Kino.to. However, new research from the European shows that the effect on end users was short-lived and relatively limited. Researchers examined clickstream data for a set of 5,000 German internet users to see how their legal and illegal consumption habits changed in response to the shutdown. While their levels of piracy consumption went down 30% during the 4 weeks following the Kino.to shutdown, their consumption through licensed movie platforms only increased by about 2.5%. And then,
so it doesn't naturally turn you from being a horrible, nasty pirate person into a morally upstanding person who pays for all their content,
indeed.
Right?
Indeed. And Kino.to was replaced by several new streaming services.
Much like the Pirate Bay has been replaced by all the mirrors.
Right.
The Hydra effect. So you cut off one head and lots more heads grow.
Yeah.
So what this suggests to me is that the commercial streaming providers aren't doing it right or aren't doing it at the right price.
No way, Martin. Say it isn't so.
I think that's a fair conclusion. Don't you think that maybe they're not meeting the demands of their consumers?
I don't think it's necessarily not the right price. I think it's probably to do with
the right content.
Yeah, not the right content, too much region-specific stuff. Not, having to subscribe to a million different services if you want to get all of the programs. Whereas you only need to use one BitTorrent search portal to get all of them.
Yeah.
But they're on hiding to nothing. They can never win that. They can never win, all content is on, let's assume the Pirate Bay, right? All content is there. It doesn't need to be ABC content, HBO content, BBC content. It's all there. You can't win against that. You know, whatever cross-licensing deals you do, unless it's a multi-platform cross-license deal across all content providers, you cannot win. You can get some of them, but you can't get them all.
But people buy MP3s or buy Spotify subscriptions and things now. And yet that must
they
be
do,
the same
but,
for
you know,
music.
Well, it is. And Taylor Swift isn't available on Spotify. So what do I do? You know, I have to go and walk down to the shop and buy a CD or pirate it or whatever, whatever other options are open to me. So there is no single platform. There's some of them that are, that have got a lot of content, like iTunes has a lot and Amazon has quite a bit and Spotify has some. But for any of these types of content, there's no one universal provider other than the illegal, dodgy, guy on the internet providing you with illicit downloads, unfortunately.
The arcade emulator MAME has announced that it will be released under an open source license. While the source code has previously been available and the product project has accepted third-party contributions in the past, reuse of the code was limited in ways including prohibition of commercial use, meaning it wasn't truly open source. The stated aims of moving to a proper open source license include helping legal license owners distribute their games and providing a learning platform for developers.
So what can you do with MAME?
Play games.
You can use it to it to play old school arcade games
you can think of. Yes.
Yeah. Pac-Man, what's it called? Gauntlet was always my favorite.
Basically, name any arcade game from Pac-Man onwards, and the answer is yes, you can probably play
it. As far as I'm concerned, this means Bomb Jack, 1942, Commando, and Yi Ar Kung Fu and Outrun, and there you have it. That's the entire gaming requirement of any man in the world ever.
He's not wrong. I think that's the end of the news.
And we've got some events. OpenTech, that's opentech.org.uk, is happening at Student Central, or ULU, that's the University of London Union, on Mallet Street in London, or Malay Street, maybe?
I don't know.
On Saturday the 13th of June, tickets are £5 on the door. Highlights include Privacy, Ripper 2 and Snowdenia.
I'd have pronounced that Snowdenia.
That's stuff about Edward Snowden. Snowdenia, there we go. Being female on the internet, selling ideas, the open rights group at 10 years old, open healthcare, privacy, health, three digital services, data and policy, the election, what happened, and the election, what's next. So this looks like quite a cool event. It looks like the kind of thing that people who enjoy Og Camp might enjoy.
It's been pimped around on the local Linux user group mailing lists in the UK, and I think that's exactly the kind of nerdy target audience, open culture kind of people who would go to that kind of thing. It's in London, did you say?
Yeah.
Yes. Yep. And we also have PyCon UK, which is a little further off. It's Friday the 18th to Monday the 21st of September 2015 at the Coventry University Technology Centre. For the fourth year in a row, there'll be an education track. They look forward to welcoming teaching colleagues and young Pythonistas of tomorrow. This time, they'll be joined by Django Girls and Transcode, both of whom will be providing Python training for new members of our community, or of their community, I should say.
Awesome.
So I'd just like to say that if you're a Python developer or an aspiring Python developer and you're in the UK or in a part of Europe that's easily accessible to the UK, you should absolutely go to this event. Where I work, we're a Python shop. We've been going to PyCon UK for years. It's a brilliant event, and in particularly, it's a multi-day event, and each day they have UK peasant food. It's absolutely brilliant.
What?
Brilliant. Yeah, so they do things like Cornish pasties and fish and chips, and it's good, honest peasant food to feed the developers. But the tracks are really good. There's more going on there than you can possibly fit in. The venue's a really great place to be. It's right in the heart of the university. There's a lot going on there. It's a great event. So if you're into Python or want to get into Python, it's a definite must attend event.
Excellent. Thanks very much for that. Well, that just flew by. That's all for episode 7. We'll be back next week when we'll be discussing getting involved in open source projects, and we'll bring you some command line love, as Mark likes to say.
Oh dear.
Seamless. Dear. Absolutely seamless.
Yep.
No audio issues at all.
No,
I jinxed
that's
it.
All.
That's all going to fail now.
It's all fine.
Brilliant. See you all next week.
Bye
bye.
Bye
bye.
and stop recording.